Opinions expressed in this program are for general information purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.
Welcome to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham on AM 770 KTTH. Whether it's preservation of capital or an aggressive growth strategy, every investor needs a clearly defined risk profile. Know Your Risk Radio is brought to you by Bulwark Capital Management, helping families navigate the ever-changing and often treacherous financial markets. Know Your Risk Radio starts now. Here's your host, Zach Abraham.
All right, welcome back to the show, and thank you so much for joining us for the most scintillating hour in finance radio. As Darren aggressively nods his head, we got the millennial back at the helm, which is big because I believe the last time Jerry was driving this ship is when we had our snafu, wasn't it? Yeah. Of course, we blamed it all on Darren. You know, because he is the millennial. That's kind of the role. He's like the resident whipping boy, if you will. Anyway, thank you so much for joining. It's got a great show planned for you, as always. Well, I guess that's my perspective. Maybe you don't feel the same way. But before we get started, I'd be remiss if I did not wish you all a happy Memorial Day weekend. I love this weekend. I don't like that it exists because it's a weekend that reflects prices paid for the freedom that we all enjoy. And I said a prayer on the way up here to the studio today, praying for peace and, calm and good memories for all the families that have paid that ultimate price that we all enjoy every single day. And for the families out there and the service that have lost loved ones, for the service members that have lost brothers in arms, may the weekend be filled with good memories and peace and comfort. And thank you so much for the price that you've paid that my children and I get to enjoy. And I can't thank you enough. And you'll be on our minds and on our prayers this weekend, in our prayers this weekend. And, yeah, just peace and great memories at the noble sacrifice that so many of you have made. So thank you and God bless. Anyway, to get on with the show, kind of hard to move on after something like that. Just not sad, right? But a reflection back on the incredible souls that have given so much. I think that gets lost in the din and the noise of today's society. But anyway, the show goes on, and got a great show planned for you today. And coming up, second half of the show is going to be an interview with an old guest, one of our first guests we had on the show, Tobias Carlisle. Brilliant guy. He's become a good personal friend, as a matter of fact. And he's launching a new ETF that we're going to that you can invest in if it's suitable. I'm not advising you do it. We are using it in certain circumstances with our clients because I think it's a phenomenal investment, but it's got to fit your needs and you need to consult a professional before buying it. Of course, you can call us, but a brilliant guy, published 4 books. It's amazing. He's one of those guys, Darren, that makes me feel a little insecure because he's only 2 years older than I am, but I'm sitting there going, man, how have I wasted all this time? You're out there publishing 4 books, you've started a firm, I'm working on my first book. So he's outpacing us. And as a matter of fact, he's actually going to write the foreword for our book. So, but anyway, we're going to have a great conversation with him. It's going to be centered around value, in my opinion. Tobias would never say this, but I think he's quickly emerging as one of the leaders in value investing. He's still relatively young, but the research that he and his firm do and the depths that they dive on value stocks, right? We're always talking about that. I think is invaluable, and I think the guy is spot on. So definitely something I want you to listen to. And He knows his stuff. Value's not popular right now, right? But that's, we're not playing a popularity game, people. We're playing an investing game. And regardless of the noise, regardless of what the Jim Cramers of the world say and CNBC, look, at the end of the day, investing all comes down to one thing. Buying an asset for less than its intrinsic value and holding it until it goes above that level or gets to that level. That's what investing is. And we get caught up looking at the stock tickers and the movements and the trends and all, and we often forget. We lose perspective. We don't see the forest for the trees. And the thing we got to remember is markets and investing, and they don't care. Right? If you're paying too much, Warren Buffett, right? There's no such thing as bad assets. There's just bad prices. And unfortunately, based on the historic overvaluation we have in today's market, and I don't care what you think the economy's going to do. I don't care how high you think Trump's going to run things. I'm not saying he will. I'm not saying he won't. What I am saying is just like I would have said about a housing in 2007. And to some extent, you could even say housing today. These things will return to their intrinsic value because they always do. And the longer we go, the more wrong guys like me will look, but it will happen. And the longer we go, it's a funny dynamic. I was actually talking, I've got a researcher, thank goodness, brilliant guy, that's helping me with the book because I don't have time to do all the research myself. And he and I were talking about this today. And we were talking about risk and we were talking about the different aspects of the book that we're writing. And one of the things that has always fascinated me is that human beings, if they own these overpriced stocks and these overpriced funds, and they're what we call a price insensitive buyer, they're lulled to sleep over a long enough period of time. They go, hey, Zach, yeah, I hear what you're saying about value, but I'm up 20%. I'm up 30%. And you said 2 years ago when I first heard you on the radio that things were overvalued. Now, I'm going to point out that the markets are below, right? They're flat to negative over the last 18 months. So, you know, be that as it may. But at the same time, the longer the bad event doesn't occur, the more confident people are. And in reality, we should look at it completely different, right? And think about it this way. If we get on a run at a blackjack table in a casino, you watch people start putting chips in their pocket. They know it's not going to last. You flip over to the stock market and they do the exact opposite thing. It's fascinating to me. And why is that? It's because they don't have a good grasp of risk and the way that risk works. And when everything has been great, when markets have run without a significant pullback greater than 20% for a 10-year period of time, we've got, you know, 9 out of 10 valuation metrics at historic highs, never been higher. Everybody forgets because it doesn't matter. And unfortunately, that is when it matters the most, because as we talk about on the show all the time, what is the easiest way? Now, it's not easy in practice, but in principle, what is the easiest way to improve long-term returns? It's not chasing market highs. It's the preservation of capital and the limiting of loss in the inevitable down cycles, and nobody wants to talk about that. Well, we do, and we're gonna hit on it. And one of the things, like I said, doing this book has been really an exploratory process because it makes you dig in to the philosophies that you yourself hold, you know, that you may not hear yourself say on a daily basis. Right. Think about your job, right? There's all this. If you tell people what your job entails, you'll give them a broad overview, a 30,000 foot view. But there's all these details that you don't even think about anymore because they've just baked their way into your muscle memory. They've baked your way into their subconscious because you've done them so many times. And going through this book process has been like that for me. Oh, yeah, that's right. I do think that, or that is a principle. And I forgot that, yes, we do this, but I forgot the original reason why, right? And one of the things that we talk about risk a lot on the show, but one of the aspects of risk is change. And I've said this before, but one of the periods of time that we're really focusing on is 2008, 2009. And we're focusing that not because of the horrific market event that occurred, but more about the interrelationship between change and risk. And what happened in 2008, 2009, the world changed. The global financial system changed. It changed in so many ways, we couldn't go through even half of them if we had 6 hours to do it. It'd probably take weeks, actually, to break down all the different ways it changed. But one of the biggest factors, and I think one of the easiest ones to observe, is that no longer were free markets and capitalism and the productivity of capital the biggest driver of asset prices. It was now central banks, the printing of money. That is new. Now, it's been done in different points in history, like with, you know, to some extent, and it was way more complicated than this, but some extent in the Weimar Republic and in Germany and circa, you know, right after World War One. It certainly happened back in the Roman times. It happened back in the medieval times with, you know, England taking out debt that they never planned on repaying from I believe it was Spain and Italy. We've seen these things before, but never so direct and never so focused at public markets, because public markets are relatively new. I mean, they've been around in certain capacities, but the way that we have them today, thanks to the internet and thanks to, you know, just finance in general growing and globalization, that never before have central bankers been able to inject right in the heart of the matter and drive assets up. The other thing that changed was all of a sudden interest rates, which we've said are synonymous with risk rates, right? And we all know this inherently. The greater credit risk you are when you go to buy a car, the higher interest rate you're going to pay. Well, as it relates to most or virtually all sovereign debt out there now, debt that governments own, and to a large extent, corporate debt, that interrelationship between interest rates and risk no longer applies. Interest rates are what central banks want them to be. And why does that matter to you? Because interest rates, if you think about it, are the foundation of the international financial system, right? The global financial system. Because interest rates are the price of money. If we don't know what the price of money really is, which we don't, and people will disagree with me and go, ah, well, the 10 years, 2.5. Look, those interest rates are what central banks want them to be. So we know inherently that those interest rates are not reflecting their actually their clearing price, right? What the market would actually have them at. What should they be at? I don't know. Because I don't know. They should be a heck of a lot higher. I know that it's insane to think about Italian government debt trading at a premium to U.S. government debt. But I don't know what level it should be at. My suspicion is that Italian government debt should be somewhere above 6%. Why do I say 6%? Because at 6%, they're structurally insolvent. And if you have a level like that, that is so close to where you're currently going, markets will run you to it. That's the way markets work. They're going to take you to the breaking point, especially when it's 6%. Think about that. A government that is insolvent, if their debt cost, if their servicing cost of their outstanding debt is at 6%, they're insolvent. Or they're insolvent. Well, I would posit to you that they're insolvent now. They just don't know it. If 6% breaks your back, you're already cooked. Right? So getting back to this interrelationship between change and risk, what happened? Right? We have the central bank intervention, and it took a while for markets to accept that and normalize to it. But what's the real underlying story? And I equate it, I'm going to be equating it in the book to the extinction of the dinosaurs, right? You sit there and you go, why did the dinosaurs go extinct? Well, they went extinct because there is, some people, it's an asteroid. I mean, I think that's the best science. I'm no paleontologist by any stretch of the imagination. But having said that, I think the science is pretty clear. There was a large asteroid that hit. And they go, that killed the dinosaurs. And I go, no, that didn't kill the dinosaurs. The dinosaurs' inability to adapt to that change is what killed the dinosaurs. Because it didn't kill all life, right? Their inability to adapt. And this gets us back into our discussion constantly about the modern 60-40 portfolio. And if you're listening to this show, turn it up right now. Okay? It's free advice. I know all the caveats. I know all the, free advice worth what you pay. But just hear me out here for a second. If you're sitting in one of those 60-40 portfolios, that portfolio was built and designed for a bygone era. It was built for a period of time in which debt and equities were inextricably linked. When one dropped, and I know you've heard this from your financial professional, when stocks go down, bonds go up, all that. Okay, that hasn't happened for 10 years, and I've said a million times on the show before that that interrelationship between stocks and bonds, if you look at the last 150 years, that interrelationship between stocks and bonds that all financial advisors talk about, it's been true 30% of the time. But why do we treat it like gospel? Because the vast majority of that 30% has occurred in the last 40 years. And unfortunately, as human beings, and this gets into the growth versus value discussion that we engage with Tobias on, and that I started the segment on, as human beings, we're inherently exposed and vulnerable to recency bias. Well, look what it's done over the last 40 years. Well, look, at the last 40 years, you didn't have central banks in there buying everything up like drunken sailors and suppressing the real cost of money. And for that matter, that interrelationship broke down in 2008 and it still hasn't regained its footing, which is normal, right? Because it's only occurred 30% of the time. Yet here we've got these portfolios that are still archaic. We've got dinosaur approaches to it, right? They're not changing. I had a client the other day. Well, no, in the last year, joined us. Ex-NFL player, played in the NFL many years. If I said his name, you guys would all know him. Obviously can't do that. But he'd been with a guy for 11 years. And his 60-40 portfolio had produced annualized returns of like 3%. And if you look at what he was told that performance would be over a period of time, it didn't even come close. It was way off the mark. It was very similar to my mother-in-law's portfolio, which I've talked about. Right? Why? Because it was built for a bygone era. We're asking that portfolio, the whole design of that portfolio was built around the idea that stocks would do 11% a year and bonds would do somewhere between 5 and 6. Right now, stocks have the possibility of carrying that average. They haven't over the last 20 years. And 20 years, and the reason we bring this up, guys, is how long does the average retirement last? Right? What is that period of time? We're doing all this saving and investing our entire lives for what? For retirement. How long does it last? On average, about 20 to 25 years. Why are we relying on 100-year averages to determine the composition of our portfolio? Nobody's retirement lasts for 100 years. But that's what your retirement is based on. Why? Because they can show you really neat graphs that give you an artificial sense of security, and they can sell it. Remember, there's a big aspect of marketing built into this. So you go, okay, Zach, well, you're saying that's wrong, and you've provided good data, which we've got tons of it. Not just anecdotal, factually, these portfolios haven't worked. Matter of fact, most of them have missed by 50% over the last 20 years. So if you retired 20 years ago and you were relying on this portfolio to produce what it was, guess what? You missed by 50%. And as I've said before, if that's okay with you, then don't pay somebody a fee. You can miss by 50% on your own. It doesn't take any special talent to underperform your target performance by 50%. Hey, you could do it like a professional. And so what does it mean? What it means is we've got to take a different look at these things rather than relying on these antiquated averages that haven't played out. And therein lies the irony. I guarantee the vast majority of you listening to me today are still sitting in your 60-40 portfolios. You've seen 20 years of horrific underperformance, but your advisors, you just got to ride it out. Well, when do you not? When do you sit there and say, it hasn't worked? We need a new approach. We need to lower fees. We need to manage risk. We need to make sure we need to have a portfolio that we're confident that a 2008-2009 may not be pleasant, but it's not going to mean we have to go back to work. How do we do that? We do that by managing risk. We do that by lowering the expenses on a portfolio. We do that by lowering your exposure without giving up upside. How do we do that? Well, the first thing we do is we get rid of the bond portfolio and exchange it with one of our programs. One of our bond, you know, our bond replacement portfolio that is insured against loss with no management fees that gets about 50 to 60% of the upside of the stock market. Market's going up, you're gaining with it. Not as fast, but you're gaining with it. And these things have averaged anywhere from 4.5% to 7%. Okay? But they also have no management fee and they're insured against loss. That's one of the big ways we do it. We also do it with our ETF portfolios that are algorithmically managed. There's better ways to do things, guys. And if you're interested in that, if you're sitting in the old 60-40 or 70-30 or 65-35, we're not just talking about security. We're talking about better upside when markets go up. If I'm wrong and everything's fine and markets will continue to run, you'll make more money in these portfolios. We're paying less fees, having way less risk. So give us a call, 866-779-RISK. Again, 866-779-RISK. Go to the radio show website, knowyourriskradio.com. Go to our website, get our white paper, request a meeting with me. We can do a portfolio interview. We can have a conversation over the phone if that's not comfortable. If you feel like that's a little bit too much of a commitment, you can also just email us and we can do it back and forth over email. Anyway, we got to run. Enjoy the conversation with Tobias Carlisle coming up. And we'll talk to you next week. Again, happy Memorial Day. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.
Do better in bull markets. Do better in bear markets. Pay less fees in all markets. You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management. You can subscribe to Zach's free newsletter, The Bulwark Insider Report, at knowyourriskradio.com.
I have to tell you, what a relief for my wife and me when we got signed up for long-term care coverage. The more I learned about the fact that nearly 3 out of 4 of us will need some form of long-term care in our retirement, there are so many issues at play. For some people, they can't afford it and they become a burden on their friends and family. For others, you do have money set aside, but it wipes out everything that you've saved. And maybe most importantly, it's about having a plan so that all your children have to do is carry out your wishes. It's not a burden on them. And that's why I love the advice we got from Brian Ott and 525 Advisors. We started by going to one of Brian's free classes, and that's what I recommend you do to find out about all the different plans they offer. Brian does have a few classes coming up this month. Seats are limited, so sign up now at 525longtermcare.com. You'll get a free copy of Brian's book. Too. Go to 525longtermcare.com, 525longtermcare.com.
Volatile markets are never fun, but it provides the opportunity to see exactly how much risk you're exposed to. Like Warren Buffett always says, when the tide goes out, you find out who's been swimming without their trunks on. Hey, it's Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital and host of Know Your Risk Radio. Chances are the defense portion of your portfolio, the bonds, got hit right along with your stocks. So what do you do? Look, safety doesn't have to mean lower returns. By using our bond replacement strategy, our clients have actually increased their returns while being insured against loss and all the while lowering their fees. Call now and get your free copy of our brand new booklet, Common Sense Investing, and learn how to protect your retirement against loss but still participate in market gains. Call 866-779-RISK. Again, 866-779-RISK. Or go to knowyourriskradio.com.
Bulwark Capital Management is a DBA of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.
You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.
All right, welcome back to the show, and thank you so much for joining us. Got a special guest. I call them all special, but... This guy really is. He was one of our first guests. We haven't had him on in a long time. Guy that I've gotten to know, had the privilege to get to know personally, and brilliant guy. Great, you know, author of several books. And I believe the last time we had him on, we were talking about his new book, The Acquirer's Multiple. And anyway, without further ado, Tobias Carlisle joining us. Tobias, thank you so much for being with us, and welcome to the program.
Hey, Zach, thanks for such a kind introduction. It's a real pleasure to be back. I love speaking to someone who has such a broad view of the markets as you do.
Well, broad. You know, I'm not sure that that's good. but hey, I'll take
I'll
it, man.
It is. Here's the thing.
Go ahead.
I don't think anybody cuts across equities and commodities and other interesting sort of strategies as you they do. I don't think anybody does it as well as you do. So I'm excited to be back. And as I've got to know you, I realize why, because you're a super smart guy and you got a lot of depth under the hood.
Well, thank you. You know what? I'm just going to be quiet and just let him talk. And I got to make sure that my wife hears this as well, right? Anyway, well, hey, the reason we're having you on now. I don't think I've ever had anybody. No, I don't think. I know for a fact I've never had anybody on where I could say, look, I believe in this guy's approach so much that we're actually investors in what you're currently doing. So you've had some big happenings here just in the last 2 weeks, and launching your first your ETF, which is based on your book, The Acquirer's Multiple. But I don't want to botch this. Why don't you explain to us what you have done, what this milestone is that you and your firm just passed?
Well, thanks very much. That's also very kind. We've just launched our first ETF. It's called the Acquirer's Fund, and the ticker is ZIG, as in zig when the market zags. The strategy is a 130-30 long, short, deep value approach. So what that means is that we're sort of old school traditional value investors. We take a holistic view of valuation of these companies. We try to get them as cheaply as we possibly can. We want, you know, robust balance sheet, strong business generating cash flows, and a management who's treating us right in the sense that they're buying back stock if they're undervalued, paying down debt. So it's the sort of thing that over the long run has been a really great strategy. On the short side, we want to look at stuff that, you know, it's really hard to come up with a valuation for it because it's a pretty junky business. It's got a pretty junky balance sheet with a lot of debt in there. They might be issuing stock just to stay alive or issuing debt just to stay alive. And they've got these indications of statistical fraud, statistical earnings manipulation, or statistical financial distress. Now, that describes a lot of the businesses that are out there that are sort of new economy style businesses where the narrative, you know, the story is the thing that's captured everybody's attention. But when you look at the truth of the business, which I think is revealed in the financial statements, what it shows is that they're probably businesses that are just being supported by venture capital money or money that they've raised in an IPO, which, you know, that's an IPO is just a way for VCs to shift what they're holding onto the public. And many of these businesses are not great businesses. So that's how we construct the portfolio. Of course, I should just mention this last bit on the long side. Even though it's a really junky business with a really junky balance sheet, often the stock can keep on soaring ahead because folks don't realize. They're sort of listening to what management's saying. They're listening to the story, and they're not looking at the reality of it. So the last thing we do is we just make sure that the stock's not up over the last 12 months. And the reason that we do that is we think that shows that investors are getting a little tired of the story that management's telling, that it's not resulting in the returns that they've sort of been promising. And we think that that's the time when the stock starts to fall over and it starts to collapse. And we want to get there just at that point where the narrative is deteriorating and the reality revealed in the balance sheet and the financial statements is coming true. And so a great example of that, and we don't hold it right now because a lot of what has happened, a lot of the fall has already occurred, but Tesla is a great example of that. And we can talk about that a little bit more if you'd like to do that.
Oh, well, that's been a real popular topic on our show. We've spent a good amount of time going over that one, so we will dig into that one. But before we do that, I want to get into the composition of it. So you said 130-30. I thought we were 130. We're 130 long, 30% short?
130-30, that's
okay.
Right. So
okay.
We're concentrated into the 30 companies that we think are the most financially robust, best able to survive some sort of weakness in the market, and best able to thrive under a different regime where basically I don't think they've been recognized for their quality yet. And we hope that as the market sort of moves away from this growth time and moves into a more normalized sort of market, then these are the sort of companies that will be rewarded.
Yeah. And while we were driving up here, and I don't want to lose my focus because I want to dig into that 130-30 composition and how you put that together. But the reason that we found it attractive and that we've implemented it in probably the majority of our client accounts, you know, obviously different size and different scale depending on the client, but it kind of reminds me of the old Wayne Gretzky quote, you know, which is he said that we're skating to, I'm not skating to the puck, I'm skating to where it's going, right?
Right.
And I think that that's the part of investing that investors lose sight of. Reminds me of a client meeting I was having recently, where it was a prospect actually, and I was sitting there showing her my portfolio, and she goes, "Well, why do you own those stocks? They haven't done very well." And I kind of paused and looked at her, and I go, "That's exactly why we own them. I'd prefer to buy things before they go up." I think the proliferation of ETFs has kind of played into that, right? Because people are sitting there going, well, you know, last month and a half, the market's up 14% and you're only up 3%. And we've lost sight of this short term. We call ourselves long term investors, which is why we're investing in these ETFs. We're just going to hold them, you know, to infinitum and just ride it out. But it doesn't work that way. Right. I mean, we got to skate to where the puck's going. And I know you can talk about this in far more detail and far more eloquence than I can. But value is always something that we're attracted to. And I know you're the same way. But we're also coming off of a historic rout of value as it relates to growth. Correct.
Correct. This hasn't happened before, which is amazing. Looking back in the data, so we've got, you know, we don't have all of the data going back to the very first invention of the stock market under a Buttonwood tree in Wall Street. We don't have that much data, but we've got pretty good data going back to the 20s. We've got very good data going back to the 50s, and we've got point in time data going back to 1963, and so we can look back. And we can see through each of those time periods, there's nothing like this. And that surprises some people because they'll remember the dot-com boom. And that dot-com boom, it was a wider outperformance of these junky companies over the more quality businesses, but it was a much shorter one too. This one has been incredibly drawn out. And every time it looks like there's a little recovery in value, there's been an intervention by a bank, either in a central bank, either in the States or overseas, and it seems to have snuffed it out. But I think we're at that point now where it's so wide and the boat is so loaded to one side that you need to have a little exposure to value. And I think you need to be looking to increase your exposure to value, because that when that gap closes, it happens very quickly. It can happen in a year or two, and a lot of that underperformance disappears over a year or two, and then it goes back to a more normal environment where value earns a little premium for the most part. And I think we're at that point in the cycle where it's primed to do that.
Well, and you know, going back into the history and the data as well, it supports it. I mean, the value has, over the long run, solidly outperformed, and I don't think it's different this time. That will be the trend. People will pay up for value. They will probably do so under some modicum of distress, right? When they realize that, you know, the rug is getting pulled out from underneath them, and these, you know, it's like we're looking at Beyond Meat. I know you know the stock Beyond Meat, right? We were actually looking at that leading up to the IPO because we thought that it had some good upside in it, and I think it was going to set the IPO at like 23 or 24 bucks, and we thought, okay, if we can get in there and buy it below 30, it'd be a good short-term trade because I think it had some momentum. Well, with the first day of trading, it was up 130%, and I think it was pushing 60 bucks, you know? And you just sat there and went, holy smokes. They did $88 million in revenue last year, and they're sporting right around a $6 billion market cap. Or, you know, Zoom Technologies, same way, right? And so you look around at the landscape and you go, yeah, this has got to happen at some point. And then watching the pounding that value's taken, where you're looking at these companies and they're doing well, and you look at the valuations, you're just scratching your head going, why are people not paying up for this? So I definitely agree with you. I think it's coming. Now back to the composition of the fund. I know you're not the first guy. This 130-30 approach has been an approach that, or an allocation or a structure that other people have used. How do you pick that? Kind of explain to us why the 130-30 approach. And you also have to deploy some level of leverage, but I don't know how that works in an ETF. So kind of explain to me why, you know, the story behind that composition, and then how on a structural basis you guys actually put that together and how you accomplish that.
The way to think about it really is two portfolios. So you're long this portfolio of undervalued stocks, and then beside that portfolio, you have this market neutral 30-30 portfolio. And what happens is that the undervalued stocks will do what undervalued stocks do, which is for the most part over the long term, over 3 and 5 year periods on a rolling basis, value pretty consistently outperforms the market. That's not been true for the last 5 years, but that's an unusual period in the market. And typically what's happened after periods of underperformance like that, you've had periods of particularly good performance. Then on top of that, you have a 30-30 market neutral. So it's market neutral because it's as long as it is short. And all that you're trying to generate out of that part of the portfolio is the arbitrage as historically wide spreads close together. And then that's rebalanced on a regular basis. So we're going back to the cheapest and the most expensive and trying to get that. And then what happens is if the market goes down, you hope that the market neutral generates a little bit more return than you lose on the long side. And so you get a little bit of a hedge on that side. And as the market goes up, you hope that it's a contributor on the long side and it generates a little bit more performance. So it gives you this very interesting return profile. It's hard to implement. It's a lot of guys have tried and failed. There's nothing inherently bad about the structure, and it's a very modest level of exposure. There are, you know, so a competitor of mine, and I'm a fan of his work, and I like what he does. But Joel Greenblatt, who runs Gotham Funds and wrote the fabulous book, The Little Book That Beats the Market, He has this approach that he calls the magic formula. That's basically he looks for wonderful companies at fair prices. I've done some research through my books, and we talked about this a little bit last time. The acquirer's multiple, that's just a value approach, and it seems that over time it does a little bit better than the magic formula. But if you go into Joel's funds, he gives you exposure of 160%, 170%, 190%, and then tries to hedge that out on the other side. I don't think there's anything wrong with that approach. I think that you could easily do it. I'm just a little bit more conservative than that, so I just try to stick a little bit closer to a long-only fund.
Gotcha. Now, and how do you – maybe leverage isn't even the right term. Again, I'm unfamiliar with how that would happen inside of – I mean, inside of a hedge fund, it's pretty easy. You just – you lever up and you accomplish it that way. But how does that structurally work inside of an ETF?
Well, you're hedged out by the fact that you're – by selling that 30% short, you get a rebate and some cash back in from that, which you can then deploy again long.
Gotcha.
So that there's not a great deal of leverage in it, even though the active exposure of the fund is actually 1.6 times the fund if you add it together, but the 0.6 is hedged. So it's a little bit like a long, it's a long-only fund in some respects with this market-neutral part attached to it.
Right. So what it's doing then, and I think this is the important aspect that you know, if listeners could take one thing away, and the reason we think this is attractive, is it's concentrating us in the sector or the you know, I guess it's not a sector, but you know, the class of stock, this value type, undervalued stocks. We're concentrated in that high value type stuff that we know is going to be there, good management, et cetera, et cetera. And it's then on the flip side of that, you, like you said, you've got this arbitrage opportunity that's going to act as a layer of defense in the portfolio, which is really why it fit our outline and fit our model so well, just because, you know Your Risk Radio, it's all about risk management. I'm always telling people,
right,
you know, we want to be overexposed or exposed to the good aspects of what are going on. And we want to have a layer of defense, because when this thing does, when this market turns, you and I both know, to steal a line from Luke Grohman, who we had on the show recently.
Love him.
Yeah. We think value is going to run like a scalded cat, to take his motto. And, you know, we know that in time, that overvalued stuff's going to get absolutely taken to the woodshed. So that, you know, it just really, it's very attractive, and it's been, so far we're really pleased. And I think that this approach is going to become more and more popular. And let me transition a little bit while we have this discussion, going back to another conversation I was having with a new client yesterday, and she was telling me about her friend. And she, in her words, she said, they got a ton of money and they're just almost all of it's in the S&P. Well, you and I both know that what she means is they were concentrated in an S&P fund, ETF. And, hey, that's worked like a gem. I get it. what I don't think people own these S&P ETFs or these ETFs in general, and they think they're safe. What they don't understand, it historically they probably are, but I don't think that these ETFs or the S&P 500 in particular has ever been so overweighted to growth and expensive stocks. I mean, you look at some of these 50 billion, you take a look at Netflix. Netflix is not your grandfather's $150 billion company, right? So, you know, so these people, yes, theoretically, historically thinking, that would be a sound investment. Yet that index itself, because of market cap weighting doing its little trick, you're carrying about 28% in tech, which is one of 11, you know, different sectors in there. You're overloaded on the growth side of it. You're way underexposed to value. And I just think people are way less secure owning that than they think they are, A, and B, than they ever have been. Just because we've never seen these anomalies, save the dot-com bubble. Would you agree with that? I mean, what are your thoughts?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You can look at the valuation of the S&P 500, and you can use any number of measures. And I know that each one of these has its own drawback, but each one of them brings a little bit to the party as well. So Shiller PE is a great metric that just normalizes the earnings over the last 10 years and then looks at the price of the market relative to those normalized earnings. That's at very close to historic highs. It's sort of close to where it was in 1929 right now. And yeah. If you can look at other stuff like Tobin's Q, which just looks at the replacement value of the assets versus the market value of the assets. Market value of the assets is way overvalued. It says that it's 70 to 80% overvalued. It's cheaper to go and buy these assets individually than it is to go and invest in the stock market. And you can look at any number of those approaches. So another one is Warren Buffett's favorite measure. He looks at the total market capitalization and compares that just to the size of the economy, gross national product. That also shows enormous overvaluation, roughly to the same scale as the other two. And the problem is, as exactly as you point out, the way that the S&P 500 is composed. So the S&P 500 is market capitalization weighted. What that means is that the bigger companies get more of the money and the littler companies get less of the money. If you're a value investor, that's exactly the wrong way around. What you want is the companies that are most undervalued getting most of the money and the companies that are overvalued not getting any of the money. So I can say, I can look at the composition of my portfolio, for example, and I can see that the average company in my long portfolio earns about $2 billion in operating income a year, and the average company in the short portfolio loses about $100 million per year. So I can see that the average company in my long portfolio has about 9 times coverage of its interest payments, and the average company in the short portfolio covers its debt by 0.3 times. That means it doesn't cover its debt. It doesn't earn enough money to cover its debt. The PE ratio is 10 in the long portfolio. It's 60 in the short portfolio. The buyback yield in the long portfolio, so buyback yield is how much stock they buy back every given year. And we look at a net measure. So if they're issuing options to management, we net those out. So they're buying back 4% a year. And in the long portfolio, they're issuing about 1% a year. Those are all very good signals that if you run back through the data a very long way, you see that when companies are issuing stock, they underperform materially. When companies are buying back stock, they outperform materially. And when you combine all of those other factors together, it's likely that the long portfolio wildly outperforms the short portfolio.
Over time,
absolutely right. Over a 3 to 5, you need to judge these things over 3 to 5 year periods, because you have these short run periods like we're seeing right now, where the really frothy, glamorous companies, even though they're losing money, even though the balance sheets are really weak and junky, they're still doing very well. The market hasn't yet woken up to the reality of those financial statements.
When you look at that, this is going to be a less esoteric technical question, but just in an effort to commiserate here a little bit, when you look at this environment and you look at some of these stocks, to me, I keep going back to that, and I know you know this, that interview that I believe it was the CEO of Sun Microsystems gave like circa 2002, 100%. You know, where, and I can't remember what was the amplitude of the drop on that stock. I mean, how much did it drop during the tech bubble bursting? Wasn't it like an 80 or 90% loss?
Oh, I would say 90% plus.
Okay. Okay. So, and he just sat there and really smart guy. And I agreed with him 100%, right. But he just sat there and said, look, it's not my fault if you're buying my stock at 100 PE. And then he walks through, right? He walks through the metrics of how that works. And as frustrating as it is, it's also sad because the average investor is just watching Bubble Vision, which is something we stole from another guest of ours, Bill Fleckenstein. I believe he was the one that started calling it that. But, you know, they're it's what have you done for me lately? They're just paying attention. Oh, it's the hot stocks, the hot stocks. And that we know definitively that all of these assets will return to their intrinsic value. And I'm afraid a lot of these companies, their intrinsic value is a zero because they're not money-making enterprises. When we get in times like this and you're sitting there looking at it, coming from the perspective that you come from, and I know the detailed research that you guys put in, how do you hold your clients' hands and get them to think longer term and tell them, listen, don't chase. We got to stay disciplined. We've got to stay to our plan. We know it'll work over the long run. It's like, you know, it's like Novocaine, right? Give it time and it'll work. How do you approach that? What do you tell them? How do you keep them sitting there going, hey, don't chase those returns. Stick with that disciplined approach.
Well, I think you have to give examples like the one you've just given. That was a quote from Scott McNeely, who's the CEO of Sun Microsystems. And what he said, and I think it's instructive and it's worth hearing it. He said, you know, you're paying 10 times revenues. So that's 10 times sales for this business. And so that means that in order for you to make your money back over 10 years, I have to give you every single dollar of sales, which doesn't happen, right? You've got a cost of goods sold. You've got employees who have to be paid. You've got R&D. You've got lots of other things. You've got taxes. You've got the money has to come from somewhere. And so what's most interesting is he's in 1997, Sun Microsystems was trading at $5. In 2003, Sun Microsystems was trading at $5. In between, at the very peak of the dot-com boom, it got to $64. So that's up 12 times. So people sit there and they say, well, look, the stock's up 12 times. Why, you know, you're wrong in your analysis of this company. You're wrong that this isn't doing as well as you say that it is. I say, look, just wait. These things take a little bit of time. They grab your attention for a period of time. But in between, that all of this insanity happens. But if you stay calm and you think about what happens historically and you just ignore all of the noise, you will be able to find good opportunities that are the other way that are just way too cheap, and you'll find these things that are just silly overvalued. Just wait. The world does come back to normalcy.
The other thing, too, I tell clients is, listen, some of these companies are okay. They're just way overvalued. And we will get a chance. Like I don't know the timeline, but if you still really like this firm, we'll get a chance to buy it, and we'll get a chance to buy it at a significant discount to where it's currently trading, right? This is a long-run game, and that goes right over into Tesla to get back to those comments you made. You said that that is not a part of the short portfolio that you guys are at, right?
No, so what with shorting, you know, shorting, there is some sensitivity with shorting. You don't want to be, because the shorts are just as silly as the other investors. They can be, and they can create short squeezes, and that short-term behavior can be difficult to navigate. So you need to be careful. If there are too many shorts concentrated in a stock, you don't want to own it long, but you also want to be careful owning it short, because you have to borrow the shares to sell them short. It becomes expensive, and their behavior starts affecting the returns. When I don't want the behavior of other investors affecting the returns. I want the underlying fundamentals of the business driving my returns. So one of the things we do is we just don't touch them. For a long time, the Tesla was loved by the longs. And then there was this period of time where they were getting tired of it, and that was the best time to short it. And that was about 9 months ago through until a few weeks ago. And then there's this period of time where all the shorts love it, And that's not a good time to be a short either. You want to be basically selling it back to the shorts. But in between, it was down 50%.
Yeah.
That was a great time to be holding it.
Yeah, no, we actually, we had some prescient timing on that one, which you and I both know the timing aspect of it is, you know, the novice guys stick out their chest. They're like, oh, I timed that one perfectly. The guys like us who've been through a few wars sit there and kind of sheepishly grin and go, I got lucky on that one. Yeah, because as is evident with the whole base of this conversation, you know, it's the old adage, markets can stay irrational a lot longer than you can stay solvent.
Absolutely.
But I remember when we hit that 389 mark on Tesla, and I didn't say it on the radio station. We didn't take any action in it just because we're managing retail money and couldn't. But when that 420 funding secured tweet came out, I put out a tweet somewhere and just said, look, guys, this story's out of gas. Now's the time. I wish we'd been running a hedge fund at that period of time because I would have put it on. But, you know, on the flip side, on the short side, and I know you know this all too well, again, to quote Bill Fleckenstein, or maybe it was Mark Cohodes that said this, but we want to shoot the shorts in the back, meaning that you don't want to fight that wave, right? You want to wait till those things turn around. And that's kind of that mechanism you were talking about in your fund,
right,
where you want to see the price down over 12 months. Is that kind of the shoot them in the back clause inside of the ETF, if you will?
Yeah, you don't want to shoot. You know, I love shooting fish in a barrel, but I also wait for all of the water to be drained out of that barrel, so they're just flopping around on the bottom. That's the time to shoot them.
Yeah, maybe it makes it a little easier for the aiming, right?
Exactly right.
Yeah. Okay, so we don't have much time. I know you're a busy guy. Give us a little synopsis of what you see going on, and I'm reminded of a conversation that we had down in your neck of the woods not too long ago when I was visiting down there in Southern California, and we were talking about seeing signs that this was starting to turn. Where do you think we are, and where is your sense? Obviously, we're all spitballing here, but where is your sense? What do you think is going to precipitate this rotation back into value and kind of bring it back into the sun? Do you think we've started that process? And then if you could, kind of your thoughts of the overall economy and the market.
I do think that we've started that process. I think we're about 9 months into it, and I think that these things typically run 18 months to 2 years. So I think the market had that great sell-off at the end of last year, but that really was just, I think that was just the amuse-bouche. That was just the first morsel of the meal. I don't think that's the entree. That's not the main meal. I think that's still coming. The main meal happens right at the end of that process. So lots of other times when the market has fallen off, so we can take 2007 to 2009 as an example. Market peaked in June 2009. Nobody knew it. Traded through to 2000, you know, midway through the year 2008. Still no real idea that the market was already in a bear market. It was just such a slow sell-off at that point. And then it started gaining steam in the second half of 2008, where the market really collapsed. And then it bottomed in 2009. So the actual selling was really all done over a period of 9 months, even though the bear market started more than a year beforehand. And I get the feeling that we're going to see something similar this time. It takes a long time for the real selling to start. And I think that we're coming up now on, say, 6 months through. I think we've probably got another 6 months to go before we start seeing it. And then I think we're going to start seeing some real volatility in the market, some dislocations in pricing, which I love as a value guy. I love those dislocations because that means I can set up my long portfolio. But I also love them because my short portfolio will be benefiting through a period like that. The thing that drives it, the thing that actually precipitates it, I don't know. It's always really hard to predict. I don't think that anybody actually knows. I think that after the fact, we'll come up with a reason for it.
Right.
It was the trade war. It was oil. It was China. It was something, even though we don't necessarily know. And I think sometimes my approach is just don't look for the reason, just be prepared for the event.
Yeah. I couldn't agree with you more. And then the other thing that we're looking out for, too, is it's hard to pick tops. But we were talking about Sun Microsystems at a 10 times sales. We're seeing large cap companies trading at 10, 15, 20 times sales.
Right.
We're seeing some as high as 40 and 50 times sales. in a lot of ways, you could say that this is the most extreme valuation market we've seen.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
And I think that the overall numbers, like the general terms like PEs, and you and I have talked a lot about this off air, but I think the PEs are being really obscured by the skew between how bad value's been beat up and how high these are, where we average them together and it doesn't look that bad. But when you look at it separately, you go, holy smokes, that divergence,
right.
You can drive a truck through it.
That's right. In some respects, there are sort of two parts to this market. There is the very overvalued part that everybody's keeping their eyes on, but there are all of these little, or not so much little, but there are these other companies that are just remaining undervalued that they just don't get any attention. They don't get the flows from the ETFs. They don't get attention from analysts. They don't turn up on Bubble Vision anywhere. They're the ones that are actually making money, stacking up the money every year, buying back stock, doing all the right things, get no attention. On the other hand, you've got these things that they're just a good story with somebody leading them who's very charismatic and they get all of the attention. But if you look under the hood, they're losing money and they're carrying a lot of debt. And those are the things that, you know, they're skating on thin ice. They're going to find that hole in the ice sooner or later and they're going to plunge through. And everybody will just say, what happened? It'll be down much the same as Tesla. It'll just be down 50%. Over like 6 months.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a client the other day. Before they met me, they became a client. They loaded up on Tesla at $340 a share. Uh-huh. And, you know, we just, a perfect example, right? I mean, that's what we're talking about. Anyway, but before we close this up, I want to remind everybody, the name of the ETF is ZIG. I am not advising you go out and buy this. But it's certainly something to talk to a professional about. You can always call us and talk to us about it, whether it's got a place in your portfolio. But the reason we wanted to have Toby on was because this is, in our opinion, something that could be very appropriate for a retail portfolio these days. It's going to give you the broad exposure, a lot of the same things you like about an ETF, but it's going to be concentrated in the things that are beat down. It's going to be biased against the things that have been obscenely valued. And I think it'd be a very valuable part to a portfolio, potentially assuming it suits, you know, your goals. They can find this, as you stated earlier, under the ticker. Just go to any stock lookup screen, Yahoo Finance, whatever it is. Type in ZIG, Zeta, International Gardens, right? I don't speak Greek or Latin, so I can't use the Zeta, I guess, is the only one I got right there.
But, I think in the zebra indigo golf.
Oh yeah, that sounds. See, this is why you Australians just have so much of a more polished way of saying things. That just sounds better. But and then also they can learn more about you. Also your podcast. I'm a big fan of it. You interview some fascinating people. Where do they go to find your stuff?
So the website is acquirersmultiple.com. You can read, and that's links to my books there. My books are The Acquirers Multiple, which came out in 2007. Deep Value came out in 2014. Concentrated Investing in 2016. And Quantitative Value in 2012. You can hear the podcast on that website. We're going to get you on soon because we want to talk to you about some of the interesting things you're doing, get your view on the markets as well, Zach. I love talking to you, so We're gonna spend a full hour exploring what you do on ours in due course. Once again, really love being on the show. Love talking to you.
All right, buddy. Well, hey, I appreciate the time, and I would encourage you guys all to look it up, buy one of the books. You're one of the forethoughts right now, and I'm interviewing. I know you know this, but we've got Roger Ibbotson coming up for an interview on our show. And I kind of think that you're in time. I think we're gonna view you in a similar light. I think you're going to be kind of the new modern godfather of value. So not too much expectation built into that, right?
You should ask him about his more recent popularity paper. It's absolutely stunning. I loved it.
That's on the list, pal. All right, buddy. Well, hey, enjoy that Southern California sunshine. We will be in contact. Great talking to you, and thanks for being on.
Thanks, Zach.
All right, pal, take it easy. And thank you guys for joining us. We will, as always, be back next week. Got some more exciting interviews coming up, but we got to run. Have a wonderful Memorial Day weekend, and we'll talk to you next weekend. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.
Thanks for listening to Know Your Risk Radio. Whether it's preservation of capital or an aggressive growth strategy, every investor needs a clearly defined risk profile. Schedule your free risk review at knowyourriskradio.com. Tune in next week to Know Your Risk Radio with your host, Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.